It's Success Happens on 930 WFMD, a discussion with leaders who share their pathways to success. Success Happens with your host, Jen Charlton.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Success Happens. It's another lovely, lovely day. And I, was thinking as I was driving in today that there's so much we have to be grateful for. You know, and this is a time of gratitude, isn't it? Thanksgiving, where we can reflect on not only our blessings in terms of the things that we've received, all the stuff, right? But really the being thankful and grateful for the people around us and the people in our lives. And, they say life's a journey, but, you know, it's also not a solo act. You know, you have to go through life with people. And, you know, there's so many people around us that we can take a moment this week and to just go out and reach out and thank them. Thank them for whatever, littlest things, the smallest things, it will make a difference. The big stuff too, right? We always think of the big stuff. Wow, I'm really grateful for that big thing somebody did. But a lot of times it's the little things in life that we forget to just go back and say, you know what? I really thank you for that thing you said because it made a difference for me. So I encourage you this week as we go into Thanksgiving to really think about where we can be grateful. And as my friend used to say and mentor, have an attitude of gratitude. So that being said, I am really grateful for our guest here today. And we're going to talk about something that's a little bit difficult, but it's also a part of life, you know, that circle of life. And we've talked a little bit on the show, as you all know, this past June, I lost my mother-in-law, and she was an amazing, amazing woman, extremely faithful and things. But when she went into decline, it happened rather rapidly for us. But we went through this process of what do we do? You know, where do we go? How do we get this help and support we need? And of course, by the way, she was in Chicago and we're down here. And so you're dealing with some of this long distance, long-term care. It gets complicated. So I encourage each of you to listen today for not only yourselves, but maybe people around you who may need your support as they're dealing with perhaps end-of-life issues. And so we're going to talk a little bit today with a gentleman who I'm just getting to know, and I'm just thrilled is here because I've been watching this program for many, many years, and it's called the Hospice of Frederick County. And I have with me today Carlos Graveron. And Carlos, thank you so much for being here this morning. You are the executive director of Hospice, correct?
Yes, I am, Jen. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here with you today.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And, you know, I think back, you know, many years ago in a different chapter, I lived in Annapolis and I made custom clothing. And I had a client of mine who was actually very wealthy, but she had lost her husband and he had been through hospice. And she so loved hospice that she gave quite a bit of money, actually, to hospice. And then when it was time for her, she called hospice because she knew she had complete faith, but also comfort in their care. So I've always been kind of watching from afar hospice because I'm aware of your programs through people I've known who have had to use your services or chosen, I should say, right? Chosen, it's a choice. But so I'm so glad to have you here and have us talk about this way of dealing with a chapter in our life. And perhaps it's a chapter, not only in, it's our life, but it could be for somebody around us who's ill.
Sure.
Right? So it goes both ways. And preparing for that so that at some point when that comes, we're empowered to make great choices and live out those days in a positive way.
Yes.
So that's my interpretation of hospice. I don't know if I hit any of the right notes here.
You hit it right on the nail, actually.
Okay.
It's really an educational challenge that we're up against. And in many ways, I see that as my primary role is to be an educator, a teacher, sort of an emissary out to the community to explain what it is and what it isn't, because there's so many misconceptions about what hospice is, and even people thinking that the minute you go on hospice, that hospice does something to speed your death, which is completely contrary to what the reality is. And it's only when people actually experience it themselves firsthand that they gain an appreciation for what it is. And I say that from personal experience, because I was actually working in the industry prior to actually
the industry of what?
Well,
palliative
hospice
care?
And palliative care. Yes.
We'll talk about what that is. Yes. We'll explain that to folks.
And I didn't. It didn't quite hit me completely until my father went through his bout with cancer. And it was that experience and the shortcomings of that experience that have really energized me and put me on this mission of education to the community, because I see the value that it can bring to everyone.
Yeah, very good. So let's talk about palliative care, because I think that's a term that a lot of people may not be familiar with. I didn't pull up my Google or Webster's version, but I'm pretty certain you could probably create it for the audience so they can hear what you mean by palliative care.
Sure. Well, kind of think of it this way. It's like two sides of a coin. You have curative treatments, which are designed to do just that, to cure whatever sickness or illness the patient has. When cures are not possible, the flip side of the coin is palliation. In other words, we comfort the patient, help them to ease those symptoms, to tolerate them better. And sometimes those two can go hand in hand. In fact, ideally, you want them to go hand in hand. Unfortunately, even though medicine has progressed tremendously over the last 100 years, we still haven't come up with a cure for everything. And eventually, we all meet with death, and many of us have already experienced loss in our lives with our family members and friends. It will eventually happen to everyone. So it's important to have care that doesn't just stop at the curative phase, because at some point, cures are, they sort of run their course, and then the only other option is to comfort. There's a famous quote by Hippocrates, or you might know the Hippocratic Oath that physicians take, that says, cure sometimes, treat often, but comfort always. Mm. And that's really the philosophy of hospice, that we care for everyone, regardless of where they are, to make sure that they're having the best possible quality of life for however long they have remaining.
Well, and I have to say, that's a wonderful lesson for long before you get to that point of sickness. I mean, right. We could be living that every day.
Yes. Yeah. And ideally, you know, it's a new science, really. The specialty is not all that old. Hospice in general only started in the 1980s, and it was an export from England. When it came to the United States, it was just a few small mom-and-pop operations, very similar to our own organization that started about 37 years ago. And back then, it was all volunteers. There was no reimbursement structure for it. And it was just people who cared very deeply, helping those who really had nowhere else to turn. People like Laurel Cucci, who is my predecessor, who had my position for 34 years, is really one of the pioneers of this type of care. And we're very fortunate in Frederick County to have such a long history with hospice in our community, because we've helped really countless families to get through probably the most difficult times of their lives. But palliative care in general, because it's so new, physicians really don't know what to make of it or how it's going to fit into their practices. And what we're challenged to teach and educate people about is that it doesn't replace the care they're getting from their physicians. Ideally, say a patient were to come down with congestive heart failure or cancer, at the moment of that diagnosis, you begin to experience grief. It's not when the patient passes. I remember the grief I felt when my father was diagnosed with his cancer. You need some support along the way. Physicians in their practices really have anywhere from 11 to 15 minutes with a patient. We've all probably experienced that. You get in there, and sometimes it's hard to get those questions out because it seems like they're not paying attention to you. They're documenting inside of their iPad or jotting down
And they're
notes.
Dealing with the technical, not the emotional so
exactly.
much.
Exactly. And the emotional is what takes so much time. So palliative care physicians are able to devote that kind of time. A typical palliative care appointment is about an hour. So you have that time to be able to go through those questions with the physician that you wouldn't normally have. The palliative care physicians are really great about coordinating care. Very often patients go to their physician for their cardiology condition, a cardiac condition, but they've also are seeing an endocrinologist for their diabetes. They're seeing a podiatrist. They're seeing an internal medicine physician. They might be seeing someone for GI issues. And guess what? they're doing a very poor job of talking to one another. They just don't have that much time. Just as an example, the average number of prescriptions that patients come into the hospital with here in Frederick County, 30. 30 prescriptions.
That's a lot of pills.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. many times those pills contradict one another. You might have someone who's taking a GI medication that's not very good for your heart, but yet the cardiologist doesn't know that the patient is taking it.
Well, and I want to say something about that because I just experienced this last night with my son who's been ill. And I asked the pharmacist, we got this prescription, what's the secondary thing that we can do? And she said, this will work excellent with that. So I encourage people to really use your pharmacy and pharmacist as a resource. Because if you're not asking those questions, I think you're more subject to what you're referring to.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
At some point, and that's where also, if you're the patient, you must have somebody who advocates for you, who's out there asking those questions with you at the appointments, whether it's the palliative care doc or you're going, you know, you're seeing your chronic illness doc or your general practitioner, whatever that is, oncologist. But also, you have somebody, a second set of ears with you on those appointments when you are getting your meds, because you have to have somebody looking at all this stuff.
Oh, yeah, and it's very difficult for physicians to get a grip on this because often patients themselves don't remember what the pills were for. So it's very difficult for them.
I can't remember. Yeah. I mean, it's not a function of being old, although I am getting older. But, you know, I think when it's 30, it's an overwhelming amount for anyone.
Exactly. So that function that palliative care plays to be sort of a central point of coordination for the physicians, and at the same time to address the psychosocial and spiritual issues that might be coming up with that patient during the course of their disease process are very important. So hospice is a component of palliative care, but not all palliative care is hospice.
No, I get that.
So the key differentiation between palliative care and hospice is the fact that two physicians have agreed that if the disease were to progress as it normally is expected to, that the patient has approximately 6 months remaining. Now, no one has a crystal ball or an expiration date tattooed anywhere that I've been able to find.
And hopefully they're wrong and they get more time.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we often have patients that are diagnosed, and at that point in time, yes, it seems reasonable that patient has about 6 months, but very often they have significantly more time. And often we actually even discharge patients because they've improved so much that they don't appear to be declining.
Very good. We're going to take a quick break. And as we go on the break, you know, I want to invite people, if you've had an experience with hospice or you have something to share, you just have an attitude of gratitude and you want to call in and share it, please do. 301-694-WFMD. That's 301-694-9363. You're listening to Success Happens. And I'd like to thank our sponsors, Sweeties on the Creek, which is actually closed now for the season, will reopen in February, and Xerox Complete Document Solutions. Thank you so much, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Success Happens. This is Jennifer Charlton, and I have with me today the Executive Director of Hospice of Frederick County is Carlos Graveron, and it's so great to have you with us. And, you know, we were talking before the break about palliative care, and again, I think what an amazing resource palliative providers, because it's nurses as well as docs, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and I've had the pleasure to have some interaction with them down on the Eastern Shore and some of the work they do at the hospitals down there. But let's talk a little bit about your relationship with Frederick Memorial Hospital and then how you all are integrating to meet the needs of your patients that you care for. So hospice has a kind of a unique relationship. I think typically hospice is not necessarily an affiliate of a hospital per se. So you all are a separate 501c3.
Yes.
But you have a relationship to the hospital. Could you explain that?
Yeah, we have a unique relationship, I think, with the hospital. And it's really a benefit to the community because hospices and hospitals really work best when they're well integrated. And that was one of the things that jumped out at me right away when I assumed my role, that there wasn't as much integration between the two organizations as I would have liked. So we've been working very diligently for the last 16 months or so to develop closer and closer ties with the hospital. I'm now integrated into several committees within the hospital system. We have some of our employees embedded in the hospital to help identify patients who are appropriate for the care, be able to advise and assist the hospital employees to identify who those are and to refer them appropriately for care for either palliative care or hospice.
Well, and I think that Frederick Memorial Hospital and Tom Klein Hansel as its leader have done an excellent job with their staff of really demonstrating that they are a community hospital. It really is a community model.
It truly is. And Tom has a wonderful vision for the hospital, for the community. Very forward-thinking. Just as an example, we're now, I'm part of a committee at the hospital that's looking at the development and introduction of a geriatrics program to Frederick County that we don't currently have. I think the first step along that journey, which it takes a bit of time to get a program like that up and running while they search for appropriate physician leadership to put in place, is the talk of adding a geriatric pharmacist to the staff. So we were talking earlier about the fact that, you know, patients come into the hospital on average with 30 meds, and we're talking those patients 65 and older. So it shouldn't come to any surprise for anyone on listening on the radio, because many of them, I'm sure, have those 30 meds in their medicine closet. But
or in my case, I have to line them up on the counter so I don't forget them.
Right. But it's important to have someone who is extremely knowledgeable to review those medications and to, as best as possible, sort of de-prescribe some of the things that the patients are already taking, because in many cases, they work against each other. And it's interesting that in hospice, we often see that by taking away medications, the patients actually improve. Because as we all know, every medication carries side effects, and it's that cumulative effect of so many meds that sometimes is what's the key reason why patients aren't doing better than they should.
Well, and I think, you know, just in my recent experiences at the hospital for various intakes for my family, they're very good about asking, what are your meds? But one of the things I would advise people as a non-medical professional is make sure you carry a list of your meds. Have it somewhere, whether it's in your phone or it's somewhere, because when you're under the gun and you're not feeling well, you're in the ER, it's sometimes hard to remember all of the list of 30 whatevers that you're taking, or 25 or however many. So I think it's incumbent upon us sometimes, because the hospital may not have all the information. And sometimes if we're under duress, it's hard to remember. So that's something I learned just with one of my family members. Really good idea to have it written down somewhere. If you're somebody who's caring for one of those patients that has a lot of meds, because it's hard to keep track of.
They truly are. And then you add on top of that issues with your health, and for example, patients with Alzheimer's or early onset who just have some cognitive issues, all that complicates the ability to communicate effectively exactly what medications you're taking and what you're not. So I'm really excited that this geriatric initiative that's really being headed by Rachel Mandel, Dr. Rachel Mandel at the hospital, is making headway. We're anxiously awaiting being able to really launch this to the community. I think it's going to provide a lot of value.
One of the things I've also been made acutely aware of in some of the work that I do is the need for geriatric psychiatry. I know that, you know, there's been some, the county executive, and I don't have the data at the top of my head, but, you know, there's anticipated significant growth. Maybe this is what's prompted this change for you guys, or expansion, I should say, a significant growth expected in the retirement age population here in the next 20 years. Likewise, you know, in other parts of the state, Talbot County being one of them, is the largest retirement community in the state. And there's one geriatric psychiatrist. So when you're dealing with cognitive illnesses like early onset or dementia or full-blown Alzheimer's, these mental health issues are really a concern for our older population. What are we doing to address the psychiatric care?
That's a great question. It's a huge problem nationally, not just in the aging community, but throughout the country. We see so many instances of those very sad stories of people taking weapons into a school and massacring people. Those are all really at the core of them all psychiatric issues that have just not been addressed and allowed to go on. And I wish I had a good answer for you this morning that I could provide in terms of a solution. It's a problem that requires a lot more work. In terms of the geriatric community.
I'm going to interject on that because you hit a hot button for me. But we have to make some tough choices. You know, we're so worried about offending that we can put people at risk. And when you allow for people who really need to be under psychiatric care to not get that care, it really is problematic for all of us. And so as a public health issue, I'm just doing a shout out that we address that. And I know at some point I'm going to have mental health on the show because I think they do a phenomenal job, Mental Health Association. But, you know, in particular, we're going to take a break, but in particular, I think this idea of geriatric psychiatry, to all our young ones who are getting ready to go off to college, consider it as a field. It's a booming business. We're going to take a quick break. This is Jennifer Charlton. You're listening to Success Happens. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Xerox Complete Document Solutions, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Success Happens. This is Jennifer Charlton, and I have with me today the Executive Director of Hospice Frederick County. And we've been speaking with Carlos about really focused on the elderly community, those who are of retirement age who may come down with chronic illness that ultimately leads to their passing, and so they seek hospice care. But what about young ones? I mean, it's not only our older community or population that is suffering this. What do you see? So I have a couple questions. One is, what do you see in terms of young people to old people in terms of the ratio? And how do you care for young ones differently than you would the older folks?
Well, that's a great question. Typically people associate hospice with the elderly. And that is by far the largest subset of our population, but by no means the only population. We have a very significant portion of younger adults. We have people in their 20s and their 30s and on up the ladder that are very, very common. You don't have to be of any particular age to avail yourself of the services of hospice. And then the ones that are that tug at your heart the most are the children. And it's not something that you normally associate kids with hospice care, but we actually see a significant number of children, and that's one of the areas that I identified as an area of potential growth and development for our own program. I'll back up to say that pediatric hospice is different than the normal hospice in one very, very key way. For an adult to take advantage of the hospice benefit, it's an elected benefit, so they decide to go in that direction. But in so doing, they give up the opportunity for any curative treatments. So if there is a cure, obviously no one wants to go on to hospice care. You want to attempt that cure prior to
Okay, I was not aware of that. So you're actually making the choice to discontinue treatments that could cure you if you choose hospice.
Yes. So, okay. There are lots of treatments out there, but what's important in the educational process is that people understand what are the chances of that procedure working and what are you giving up in return for that procedure.
Quality of life, et cetera.
Exactly. So there are some folks that elect, I want every possible thing done before I die. I don't care about my quality of life. If I can eke out, you know, another week of life, then so be it. It'll probably be in the ICU, hooked up to lots of devices that beep a lot and you can't turn off. But that's their choice, and if that's what they choose to do, then God bless them. I encourage that. But for some, if they get the facts and understand what that's going to look like, they decide to take another avenue and take the palliative measures that are offered by hospice care, which their quality of life is improved. The length of their life isn't going to be affected. But ironically, all the studies now show that patients who go on to hospice actually live longer than those that didn't and continued on with curative measures.
Okay, great. Cases. The million-dollar question, why?
Well, a lot of that has to do with the fact that these treatments all have side effects. So I remember seeing my dad go through his chemotherapy, and I saw the toll that the chemotherapy itself took on him. So oftentimes it's that that stress on the patient when they're getting the third or fourth course of chemo that potentially has a very, very small chance of having any impact, that tends to drain them more than just receiving some palliative care in the home and enjoying that time with family and friends. And psychologically, that gives them a boost as well.
How often do you see, let me ask a two-part question, then I want to get back to the kids. The spiritual component, is that important to your program? And if it is, how does that impact the longevity while in your program?
It's a huge component, actually. We have chaplains on staff, and I caution people that chaplains are not necessarily a priest or a rabbi. The conversations they have with patients aren't necessarily theologically based. They're not pushing a particular religion. No one's trying to convert the patient. They're there to support them spiritually. Whatever the patient's beliefs are, they reinforce those, and they have special education that allows them to help to guide the patient to find some meaning and resolution for themselves based on whatever theological beliefs they have, so that they can be at peace with what's going on in their lives. So it's a huge component. We also have bereavement specialists that assist with families, because it's not just care for the patient. It's overall care for the family group and even for friends. We even have programs that we can talk about later for patients who residents of Frederick County that aren't even patients of ours. We do grief support groups, everything from, you know, having lost a loved one to cancer to addiction to opioids and to overdose.
And where would they find that information? Where would they get that? So if they want to plug into one of those programs, where would they go?
They can go to our website, hospiceoffrederick.org, and we have a complete list of the support groups that we hold. We hold support groups for our police force and other first responders. We've even offered grief support groups for businesses in the community.
See, that's huge. I think that's a huge resource. I'm so glad you brought that up, because given the bizarre world we live in today, and there's no other way to describe it, you know, with the shootings and the killings and the heroin and the ha-ha, you know, it's just so prevalent.
Yeah.
So thank you for doing that important work. That's just great.
Getting back to your earlier point about the children, as I said, the difference is they don't have to give up curative treatments. And I think what they found several years back is that families weren't taking advantage of hospice because no one wants to give up on a child. I know I wouldn't want to give up on a child.
No, you fight to the end. Yep.
So they made the determination that they were going to eliminate that as a requirement. So children can actually receive curative measures while at the same time receiving care under hospice.
And that's under 18?
Yes.
Up to 18? Yes. Okay.
So it's a tremendous benefit. I mean, think about how difficult the experience is for families going through this. Now they get a nurse that comes to the home. They get a home health aide. They have access to our chaplains, to our bereavement specialists, to our volunteers, to our social workers. The medications are covered. They get any durable medical equipment that the child might need. It's all part of this bundled package that falls under this insurance benefit called hospice.
So let's talk about that insurance benefit, because I think when you hear all that litany of care that you guys provide, which is amazing, it sounds really expensive. And when you're going through this and you're just overwhelmed by the medical bills and the cost of care, how do you how do people apply for it? So in other words, with children, I know there's the CHIPS program.
Yes.
So kids are covered one way or the other, right?
Yes.
So is Medicaid, Medicare applied here in these, whether it's for a child or an adult? Can you speak to that?
Yes, we hospice is funded. I think the majority of our patients are through Medicare. It is a Medicare Part A benefit, so there is no copay. The costs are completely covered under the system. We also have Medicaid coverage for those that have Medicaid. The insurance is also covering. And we do a tremendous amount of charitable work as well. I feel very, very strongly that everyone deserves a good ending, and regardless of their ability to pay. So we accept patients who are completely indigent on a regular basis, and no one is ever turned away for inability to pay.
Oh, I love that.
And we typically accept whatever the reimbursement is from insurers, for example, as 100% reimbursement. We never pursue additional charges to patients and families.
That's phenomenal. So let's give people an opportunity. Likewise, at your website, hospiceoffrederick.org, you can go on and donate to hospice and support that important work, because, boy, we don't want people not getting care and love and comfort because they have a thought that they can't pay a bill. So, and you know, I always say, look, it's up to us. People take care of people. We, as a community, need to take care of one another. And so this is a way to do that, by supporting hospice. So really, thank you for your work. Talk further about how you deliver care. You have your house, the Klein House, which is lovely. Could you maybe, and by the way, you can go on the website, again, everyone, and see a virtual tour, which is a really nice video about the program. But speak, Carlos, if you would, about briefly the house.
Yes, the house is a really phenomenal place. I can't speak highly enough about it. It is not something that that I was associated with when it was built. It's going on its 15th year now. It's a tremendous asset to the community. We just hired a new medical director, and she was just floored when she walked into the place, because it is so unique. It is a residential facility, so it's very different than most models that you see around the country, and I can talk a little bit more about that. But it houses just 6 patients at a time at this point. You walk in, and it's just this grand home. It does not have the feel at all of a healthcare facility. We've made it so that families are going to feel comfortable. It has a very beautiful dining room where families can gather for celebrations with their a loved one who's a resident at the home. There are free access to the kitchen. It's a huge family room. There's a child's playroom. We even have a chapel downstairs where we've had weddings and christenings.
Beautiful.
And that was donated to us by Greg Callert and the Callert Foundation, which we're extremely grateful for. And then the house itself, I would be remiss if I didn't mention Carl Miller. Carl has been a longtime resident of Frederick County. He is a gem in this community, probably the most generous man that I have ever met, and really a role model for so many. In fact, this evening I'll be attending a little celebration at his home that's being put on by the Boys and Girls Club of Frederick County to honor everything that he's done for our community. So he donated the land that the Klein House sits upon right now, the 14 acres of rolling hills and picturesque views that is... it's very, very therapeutic for our patients.
And what I noticed is that the indoor spaces are as lovely as the outdoor spaces, so that there's a way, whatever maybe the patient needs at that moment, they can find some comfort in that physical space, which is so important to have people feel at home. So how many people can you serve in the house at any time?
At this point, 6 patients at capacity. We are hoping that... we can generate a campaign here in the near future to expand our ability to care for patients at Kleinhaus, because as our program grows and it's really grown exponentially in the last 15, 16 months, we see that there's real need for additional space for both adults and children at the
house.
Would
you add a secondary building on the site?
We would probably entertain adding a second wing to the house, so that we can at least double the capacity of patients that we serve.
Talk about it outside, though. If they're not in your house, how do you get care?
We care for patients wherever they call home. In fact, if you look at all the studies, about 80% of Americans want to pass in their homes. They don't want to die in the hospital. So we take care to them wherever they are. So we care for patients in their private residences. We care for patients in assisted living facilities and nursing homes, as well as the hospital, if they happen to be there and are unable to be transferred due to safety issues.
Very good. We're going to take a quick break, and you're listening to Success Happens. It's a pleasure to have you here with us today, Carlos. And we'll be right back. You're listening to Success Happens on Free Talk 930 WFMD. Welcome back to Success Happens. This is Jennifer Charlton. I have with me Carlos Gravera, and Carlos is the Executive Director of Hospice of Frederick County, and just a really great conversation, I think, about how we care for one another and ourselves in this time, this chapter of our lives where we may be nearing the end of a great journey. But I also thank you for your work and your service here in the county and the obviously the relationship with the hospital and the providers. When we look at one of the things I guess people may be saying is, well, how do I qualify for care? So you've mentioned a couple of things. One was 6 months. The diagnosis is you have about 6 months to live. Can you go through what those criteria are that really would have somebody qualify to consider hospice as an option?
Right. It's very broad. Again, that time frame is the sort of the most key component to it. We see patients, obviously cancer is one that comes to mind. People associate cancer with hospice care. And we do have a very large component of cancer patients, but that's not by far the only illness that brings patients to hospice. It could be heart disease. It could be COPD. It could be Alzheimer's. Really anything that's shortening a patient's life that will lead ultimately to their illness would qualify. The important thing to remember is that if you have questions about it, to seek some professional guidance. And we have nurses that are able to go out and evaluate patients. It's at no cost. And determine if based on their experience and evaluation, the patient appears to be appropriate. If so, then we will bring in our own hospice physician and consult with the patient's physician to determine if, in fact, they agree that the patient would qualify for hospice services. So it has to be a decision based on two medical professionals to say, yes, we feel that this patient meets those criteria. And I think that's the best way to do it. When in doubt, seek some help. Reach out for us. Yes. And, you know, we don't bite. And we're prohibited from taking anyone under care who doesn't qualify. We're extremely heavily regulated as an entity. All hospices are. And we're very careful to make sure that the care that's being given is appropriate care to that patient. And after that, the care is customized to the needs of that particular patient. We don't use a cookie cutter approach and treat everyone the same. A lot of the patient's own desires and wishes are taken into consideration, even down to things like medications and pain management. There's some patients who want to tolerate a little bit more pain in order to stay more aware and engaged with their families, and that's fine. Again, everything is tailored to them. Some want all of the services that we offer. Others might decide, I don't want to have the chaplain. I have a priest that comes to see me, and I'm fine with that. Whatever the patient decides.
There's a way to communicate. I'm thinking of the directive. Maybe you can speak to that, because I think that talks a little bit about how you want to be cared for. Right. Can you share about that?
Sure. Part of our educational process is telling people about advanced directives. For example, things like the MOLST form that people might have heard of. It's the Maryland form that's used to basically designate what you want and don't want if you're incapacitated and unable to speak for yourself. And many homes around the community have these red envelopes that are stuck to the refrigerator that have this form in there telling the emergency services folks and EMS when they show up to the house what they want and don't want done. Because if you don't have that clearly stated and signed and in place, they, by law, will have to do certain things like CPR, for example, or intubation that some patients may not want. So the only way that you have to protect yourself is to get these documents out into the public so people know what your desires are. Otherwise, you're going to have people making decisions for you that may not be in line with what you wanted to begin with.
Well, and it takes some thought, and I want to give a shout out to Courtney Stauffer, who did a wonderful job on a show with us in the past where she talked about that. So there are lots of ways to get that support. If you know that this is what you're dealing with, take the time to do the investigation, the research, have the conversations with your professionals, have the conversations with other folks who assist in this process, because the more empowered you are now, the more you'll receive what you really want then.
Exactly. And I caution folks to think, well, I'm a little bit too young to be worried about that. It's sad, but I mean, we had a case not long ago of a traffic accident where a young woman in her 30s landed in the hospital and had unable to express what her desires were. It took her down a path that I think she would prefer not to have gone. And it puts a lot of burden on the family because you don't know what your loved one wants. And now it's your responsibility to make those decisions. It adds a lot of it adds to the grief that the families experience. And it's a wonderful gift that we can give our loved ones to let them know in advance and sort of relieve them of the stress of having to make those decisions on our behalf.
And it forces us to confront something that maybe we don't want to confront. Look, none of us want to confront a mortality.
That's true.
And it's going to happen.
It will.
It will happen. Mm-hmm. So what they say, right? Live, die, pay taxes. So it's going to happen. And so the more you do the thinking now and you actually confront it for yourself, like, I don't know, what would I want if this happened to me? How would I want that dealt with? At what point am I, you know, going to go this way or that way? And I think doing that thinking is it's also good for you to do that thinking, not only as a service to your family, right, to make it a little easier for them. But, you know, I think sometimes that we just kind of, quote, don't want to go there.
Yeah.
Go there. It's much better if you're, you know, I'm a Girl Scout, right? Be prepared. So,
that's true.
Right?
Yeah. It can be actually very, very therapeutic for people to go through that. And you're right. We're all going to experience it. And that's the one thing that hospice has to offer the community, is that experience. Whether you like it or not, we are all going to experience death and our families are going to experience loss. And hiding from it and pretending it's not going to happen doesn't help anyone.
Right. So do you all need volunteers? I mean, I've never met a 501c3 yet who doesn't, so I'm suspecting you might need volunteers. How would you use volunteers if somebody wanted to give up their treasures, their treasures as in talent, how would they do that for you?
Volunteering is a huge component of the care. We couldn't do what we do without our wonderful volunteers. We were just addressing some thank you cards earlier this week to them. Again, we're in the season of giving thanks, and the volunteers are such a big portion of that. They can go to our website, hospiceoffrederick.org, to find out information. But we use volunteers in every capacity imaginable, not only direct patient care.
In other words, providers can donate their talent?
Sure. We have volunteers that go out and actually spend time sitting and accompanying patients with a life-limiting illness. We have volunteers that come in to help with administrative duties in-house. We have veteran volunteers that are geared towards helping veterans with our new veterans program that we began in January.
And let me say,
veterans sewers,
and thank you, because we've just celebrated Veterans Day, and I understand you served, so thank you for your service, Carlos.
That was my honor.
Yeah, and so that's wonderful that you're taking care of our veterans. Thank you for doing that. And so I would assume, too, if you are a veteran listening and you want to give back to a veteran, no better way to do it than volunteer for hospice and to work with some of your veterans.
It's a wonderful program. It's something that we were very fortunate to begin, and it's already making a significant impact on the community.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, thank you so much for being here. I just really appreciate your time and your service in so many ways to helping people going through a very difficult time. And listen, you can go to our Facebook page, Success Happens, post about the show. I'm going to try and be a little more active than I've been on Facebook, but we'll be coming into the holiday season. Everybody be safe. Be careful. And Carlos has one more thing to say.
I just wanted to give a special thanks to all of the staff within hospice care. I've never worked with a more inspiring group of human beings. They truly care about these patients, and I can't thank them enough.
Wonderful, Carlos. Thank you so much for being here. You've been listening to Success Happens with Jen Charlton. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Xerox Complete Document Solutions and Sweeties, and thank you, Bob Dacey. Have a great week. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.